Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 12th of September. Monday at 9 is All Things Political, and our guest this hour is Professor David Schultz. He's a professor in the Hamline University School of Business, teaching students in public, nonprofit, and business administration. His classes include professional ethics, housing and economic policy, privatization and public policy. He also teaches at the University of Minnesota Law School, election law, state constitutional law, and professional responsibility legal ethics. He's written a lot of books, some 25 books, including the Encyclopedia of the United States Constitution, the Encyclopedia of the First Amendment, and Evicted, Property Rights and Eminent Domain. He has taught at many other universities. He, as an independent scholar, covered the Republican National Convention in St. Paul and met with foreign press and media reporting on it, and was sent during the fall to Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and Finland to meet with reporters and the public to discuss the American elections. We'll have to ask him about that trip. Prior to teaching, he was a city administrator and director of code enforcement in New York State, where he enforced city and state housing codes as well as authored housing codes. We'll be welcoming phone calls. He has written some very interesting pieces about what he thinks needs to be done to stimulate, to create really jobs in this country. We'll talk about that. We'll look a little bit at the 9/11 observances, which took place over the weekend in Milwaukee. I spent yesterday afternoon with the Milwaukee Chamber Orchestra and the Bel Canto Chorus, and really thoughtful reflections from various faith communities. This at Cathedral Square in downtown Milwaukee. It was a lovely service. And it brings to mind there are many things that we need to talk about related to that, the horrible events in Afghanistan yesterday and what our policy is there now. So we'll include that in our conversation. Whatever you would like, it's All Things Political. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. Professor David Schultz, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome. It's great to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you on the air again. I'm sure that you, as many of us, watched and participated in some events related to September 11th yesterday. I was really astounded to watch some of that early news coverage and to realize nobody had a clue, except for maybe a handful of reporters, what might be happening that day. We just didn't seem to know.
Yeah, I mean, people forget about how it unfolded in terms of confusion because, you know, originally some of the reports that came out were it was some kind of a small airplane that crashed into one of the towers, and people just thought, well, maybe it's some kind of a freak accident or something. And it really sort of just unfolded very slowly in terms of a story. And most of the reporters, I think most of the American public, you know, literally didn't know what hit them until quite far into the process. And probably the only people who really realized what was going on was the fortunate aspect, I guess relative, you can say it's fortunate, it's our way of saying it, is that one flight left 20 minutes late, and the people who were on the plane that eventually crashed over Pennsylvania knew about the other attacks, and that's probably why they responded the way they did.
And kept the Capitol or the White House from disintegrating. It is, when you think about it, you can't help but say, what if, when you think about that story. And also, I remember the day that once you heard that there was one plane and another plane and then another plane, you had no idea what was coming. It was frightening.
It was really scary because, again, they just started unfolding and you just kept expecting something else to happen more and more. And not only that morning, but I would say into the day and just for the next few days, because remember, you know, we canceled all, you know, we basically shut down the U.S. airspace for I can't remember how many days, you know, until we could try to regroup as a country and regroup our defenses. And so, I mean, so literally people just kept expecting, you know, something else to happen. And literally people across the country, you know, to use the expression we're on pins and needles is probably an understatement or underuse of that metaphor.
When you think about what's happened in the past 10 years, the war in Iraq, the continuing war in Afghanistan and in Iraq, I guess you could say, actions in Libya, we have had a huge military presence in the years since. I'd like to spend just a few moments here on Afghanistan, where there was a major event yesterday resulting in a loss of life. What is it that is not going quite right in Afghanistan? Should we be changing our strategy? 10 years is a long time.
Yeah, 10 years is a long time. And perhaps I think the way of understanding Afghanistan best is to look at history. You know, both the British and then before us, the Russians, tried to go into Afghanistan, tried to build this into a stable country and were unsuccessful. And we went into it also, I think, you know, with similar problems, you know, in terms of a country that just seems to have defied being bound together is what we would normally consider to be sort of a stable, effective type of regime. And when we went into Afghanistan 10 years ago, we went in, you know, with the stated objective of saying that we're going to overturn the Taliban regime as an effort to try to root out Al-Qaeda. But we clearly didn't have a broader game plan in terms of how do we stabilize that country once we've toppled one regime? And then second, what does it mean to actually achieve success in that country in terms of either having won the war on terrorism, to use George Bush's phrase, which is what he coined, you know, as a result, or what is our measurement of success in terms of saying that we have stabilized that country? And because of that, this is in part where we are, you know, 10 years later. Also, there are a variety of other factors that have contributed to the misadventures over there. One of them is that we got diverted from the war in Afghanistan to a war in Iraq that, you know, our current president, Barack Obama, you know, in running in 2008, criticized George Bush on and said, you know, we're going to get back and focus on Afghanistan. But clearly, you know, what's happened here is, whether it be the diversions or other things, we didn't have sort of the clear objectives and clear definitions of what to do after we topple the regime. And given that difficulty with Afghanistan historically in terms of holding it together, that in part, but certainly not everything, that in part explains some of the difficulties 10 years later. But on this broader sense, which I find fascinating after a decade, is that, think about it, the world that George Bush envisioned that would occur, or what he hoped to have happened as a result of the war on terrorism, didn't materialize. And what Osama bin Laden wanted to have happen also didn't materialize.
Right. Do you think, before we move on to jobs in this country, that it's time for us to leave Afghanistan, or do you think we still have a great deal of work to do to try to achieve stabilization?
Well, in part, there's sort of that old adage, if you broke it, you have to fix it. And there's a sense in which, you know, if we were to leave the country, we leave it in ruins, and some would argue that, you know, Al-Qaeda can reassert itself there. Others have argued, and there's pretty good evidence of this, that our continued engagement in Afghanistan really isn't solving anything, that the war on terrorism perhaps has shifted from that country to maybe even Pakistan, to maybe other countries in the world, or maybe a completely different strategy that's not militaristic, which is more political, maybe necessary. You know, personally, I sort of lean towards the direction of saying that we need to be trying to affect political solutions and thinking in terms of alternative mechanisms for trying to stabilize it and the rest of the region.
Mm-hmm. On to the American Jobs Act. Before the president gave his address, and he seemed to have a bit more oomph to him last week, you wrote about what Obama should do, a real jobs bill for America, and said that a broader jobs vision would include a need to produce jobs across several sectors of the economy. It needs to be sufficient in size to make a difference. It must also be sustainable. Did he meet your criteria, or did he fall short?
Fall dramatically short in many ways. Is that many economists, Robert Reich, for example, in the Financial Times last week, suggested that the scope of the jobs bill needed clearly to be at least two to three times larger than what Barack Obama proposed. In terms of, you know, Obama's bill comes in at around $450 billion, heavily on tax cuts, a little, you know, and less on infrastructure. Robert Reich, for example, former Secretary of the Labor, argued that we're probably looking at an amount somewhere around $1 trillion, much more heavily in terms of producing jobs around infrastructure and projects, and less on tax cuts. And I tend to agree, you know, that tax cuts aren't going to do a lot in terms of producing jobs if consumers are not buying products from businesses. I gave a talk last week to a Chamber of Commerce, and I was talking to a bunch of small business people, and this is on last Friday after Obama's speech, and I asked them what they thought of the speech, and several of them said to me, you could give me all the tax cuts in the world, if consumers not going to buy my toaster, my TV, or whatever, you know, my widget, I have no incentive to buy or to hire more workers. And so Obama both offered a package that probably won't do much or won't do much before the election, which is important to him, or B, was certainly far less than what most economists are saying is necessary to really have a dramatic impact in terms of affecting the unemployment rate.
What about the jobs in construction? I know you've written about this, that he will help. Mostly men are in construction, but you've got a whole other group of people. What are you going to do for a 56-year-old woman to get a job for her?
Yeah, that's exactly the issue, is that the model that we're looking at sort of is the old WPA model from the 1930s. And that WPA model, you know, under Roosevelt, was basically trying to put back to work mostly younger men, maybe middle-aged men, you know, who have a capacity to do, you know, pretty significant heavy labor. I don't know about you, but if I were unemployed, you know, the idea of saying that I'm fit to go out and lay concrete or do piping or whatever on highways, A, I don't have the skills, and B, I don't have the physical ability to do that. And so clearly, while a jobs bill on infrastructure is a good idea in terms of putting together or putting to work one segment of our economy, and clearly will help in terms of having some spin-off effects, it needs to be a jobs bill that's aimed at a variety of different workers and variety of different realities. Again, there's a lot of people right now who are in their mid-50s who have been laid off and have been out of work for some as a year, some are 2 years. An infrastructure bill is going to do no good for them. And so, again, it needs to be something that helps a lot of different populations, and that seemed to be missing from the proposal. I thought, as you said, I thought it was well-delivered. There was passion in his speech for the first time in a long time, but the substance, I think, fell short of what he really needed to offer in terms of a jobs program for America.
What is his style? Let's do a little analysis here. He does have a pattern, and we've gotten to know him for a few years now, of rallying at some point during the campaign. He was criticized for being too laid back, and then he rallies. He was criticized for putting all of the formulation of bills in the hands of Congress, and then he rallies at the end and lets you know what he wants. What is this sporadic passion on his part? Why isn't it constant?
This is a really interesting question, and I think he alternates between sort of being the cerebral, Harvard Law, sort of Harvard Law, University of Chicago law professor, that's part of who he is, versus an effort to try to be the community organizer, the person who can sort of rally and organize people. And I think that describes him, because Obama really is two individuals. He's the community organizer, and he's the intellectual. And there are times where the community organizer is great at the passion, it's great at getting people involved, but as a community organizer, what you learn is that your job is to get others to empower themselves. And so if you look at it repeatedly during his time as the presidency, you know, he gets elected, he turns it over to Congress, he turns it over to different individuals to sort of become involved, to sort of take the initiative, and then he sort of pops in, you know, later on. And some people have described that sometimes as demonstrating a lack of leadership, or, as I would say, this is, I think, the community organizer model coming through. Conversely, when we've seen him give what I think are some very flat speeches where there's just no passion in there. There's this, and that lack of passion we sometimes criticize him for being so calm and collected. That is, I think, the intellect coming through to him, the intellectual. And I think also, you know, he has this face as a professor, you know, in reason, and that people are going to come together, that they're going to reason, and they're going to reach agreement. And in a world of rough and tumble politics where it doesn't seem to be about reason, but it seems to be about a whole bunch of other factors, I think that sometimes has been one of his downfalls, not to see the, well, if I can phrase it, the political aspect of politics.
We're listening to Engaged in All Things Political, and our guest this hour is Professor Dave Schultz. He's a professor at Hamline University School of Business, Senior Fellow Institute for Law and Politics at the University of Minnesota Law School. Our phone number, one line, is open if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program this Monday, how we teach children about the Civil War and some of the great battlefields that have been preserved from the Civil War. We'll have a couple guests with us. We go to phone calls now for Professor David Schultz, and we start with Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Professor. I was watching the Friday news on public television, and Mark Shields and David Brooks do their sort of summary of the week. And I think it was Mark Shields who said that in looking at the president's plan, that if we can't do this, we're basically fried. I mean, politically, we're kind of at a stalemate that bodes very, very ill for the people of the United States and the economy. And my question is basically, if that happens, if there are so many objections to this very, very modest proposal for jobs, do you think it lands in the hands of a perceived to be weak President Obama, or do you think increasingly Americans will come to see the House as part of a 2-0 Congress that is unable to compromise and to cooperate with the chief executive officer?
I think this is a good question, and I think if the House does, or if Congress does reject, especially the House does reject this, then I think this exactly plays into Barack Obama in terms of helping him for re-election. Because clearly, as you point out, this is a relatively modest proposal with principles in it regarding tax cuts, extending the payroll tax deduction, which are things that Republicans traditionally like. And I think what he did is set a challenge out to them, is to say, you know, here is a real simple set of proposals that you folks have said that you've liked. Vote for it if you really say, you know, and if you don't, I think this is exactly what Obama would be counting on to be able to run against the House and say that, look, they're really not interested in helping the American economy. They're really a do-nothing institution. And so I think if he plays this well, assuming the House of Representatives does reject it, I think this becomes a very important speech for him in terms of, you know, turning the tables on Congress. Conversely, what I thought is if the Republicans were smart, they actually would adopt this entire proposal. And the reason why I say that is that even assuming that this is a that there are a lot of good provisions in here, we're not going to see still a very significant decline in the unemployment rate from 9% between now and November of 2012. So what the Republicans could do is say, you know, Congress adopted your stimulus bill in 2009. We adopted your proposal, you know, this job stimulus bill last year, and look, the unemployment rate is still high. Therefore, the president doesn't have a good set of ideas or something like that. But I don't think Congress will be smart enough to actually get its act together, the Republicans, and adopt this. And so I think this plays very well for Obama if he can now sketch it out and point out that this is the body, that is the House, that's unwilling to really do anything and unwilling to work on behalf of the American public.
Thank you, Rich, very much for your call. It was interesting to listen to the Republican response because it was not nearly as vociferously negative as it has been. It was quite muted.
Yeah, there's no question about it. And I think, again, muted for some of the reasons I just outlined here is that, again, these are many proposals that they otherwise like. And two, I think they are acutely conscious of the fact that Obama is trying to paint them as the obstructionists. And if they come out right away and instantaneously against something like this, this does not play well, especially when they don't have an alternative. And that's one of the things that's important, is that for weeks they kept saying, you know, Obama doesn't have a proposal. He put a proposal on the table, and he's now saying to them, you know, up or down, you know, take a stand on it. And that's the squeeze I think they are somewhat in right now in terms of how to react to it. And I think they're still trying to formulate a decision regarding how to respond to that proposal.
And yet, to pay for the proposal, don't you have to deal with this incredibly thorny and controversial issue of increasing tax revenue, taxing those who have more? That's not going to fly, is it?
That's not going to fly at all. And that's the issue here, is that they're saying they're against tax increases, and at the same time, as a result of the debt deal that was done back in August, there is enormous pressures at this point to also find ways of reducing the amount of borrowing that this country is going to do. And so if, in fact, we're under pressure in the next few months, you know, with that special committee from the debt deal to find savings, if we're trying to do that, if they're against tax increases, there is not a lot of wiggle room here given those two positions to really adopt this proposal. They've built themselves into a box in some ways.
Louis in Wausau, hi.
Good morning. I would like to ask the guest if he's familiar with the Kauffman Foundation and the conclusion of that foundation, which studies job creation, and which concludes that all new net job creation is in companies 5 years old or less, and that the larger, older companies actually eliminate jobs on a net basis. I'd like to stay on the line for possible comment.
All right.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know the specific study that you're referring to, but I have seen studies that point out that it is the smaller startup companies that seem, in the smaller companies that are more rapidly expanding, that generate a lot more jobs than do the bigger companies. And I guess one of the questions I sort of want to follow up with you is, given that that's true, given there seems to be strong evidence for that, how do you see the Obama proposals outlined the other night in terms of facilitating small businesses, or younger businesses, I should say, younger businesses?
That's a little complex for me right at the moment.
Yeah.
I guess I'd go to the Kauffman Foundation, which incidentally is a foundation started by, of all things, a fellow named Kauffman, who started a company, made a couple billion, and put a billion into this foundation for the specific study of and promotion of startups, because he concluded that that's where all the new jobs and all the, I guess, the economic, not activity, what's the word I want, star companies are formed.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, part of what we're all trying to figure out at this point, I think, you know, when I say we collectively as a society, you know, is what is the next Google? You know, what is the next, Apple or Microsoft, the company that right now is that really good idea, but that if nurtured properly, you know, will flourish and grow and so forth like that. And Obama himself has tried to, you know, argue that it's the green economy. You know, it's the green jobs movement. Others have tried to make other suggestions, you know, in terms of where they think it is. But in general, what exactly small businesses need is a real tough question. I mean, there was a really great piece in the McClatchy newspaper chain a couple of weeks ago. I don't know if you saw it or any of the listeners here saw it, where they went out and interviewed a bunch of small businesses and asked them and said, well, are regulations and tax cuts making it hard, are high taxes making it difficult for you to expand? And almost across the board, these small businesses said, well, no, not really. The problem really is the fact that there's no consumer demand at this point. but they didn't see the regulations and taxes issue as being one that affects them. And so right now, what we're thinking about here again is, hey, it's not clear what small businesses in general need to be able to help them to thrive and expand, although some suggestions can be offered. And two, it still comes back to the consumer demand issue. That consumer confidence right now is about 20 points lower than it was when Jimmy Carter was up for re-election back in 1980. The American public is really sour on the economy right now.
They sure are. You, I know, in your plan for stimulating job production, called for 100% tax credit for solar equipping all homes and buildings. It seems striking that at a time when green energy probably is the way that we need to go to save ourselves, that sounds like a reasonable idea, and you could create oodles of jobs if you created green energy jobs, couldn't you?
You could. And the reason why I picked it especially for residential is that something needs to be done at this point still to re-stimulate, you know, the residential mortgage markets in the United States. You know, housing sales are still flat. Most people are still seeing the values of their houses erode. And given that and given sort of the need to make that transition for a new economy based around green jobs, you know, and Germany's doing it right now. Very successfully, you know, one proposal is to say, let's give, like I said, 100% tax credit, you know, for people to retrofit their homes. That would put an enormous number of people, at least in the construction industry, back to work or transitioning into trying to do that kind of work. The other reason why I mention this, too, one of the, I think, the sad stories that's come out in the last couple of weeks is that the three major solar manufacturers in the United States of solar panels, I think it's the three, have either filed for bankruptcy or significant.
Really? I didn't know that. Oh, my.
The very interesting story is that right now the major producer of solar panels are companies in China. And the American companies have pretty much, again, almost gone out of business or filing for bankruptcy. And so, again, this might be a way of also stimulating the solar industry within the United States. And so that just is sort of one proposal. Now, clearly, is it going to solve everything? No. But again, look at a country like Germany, which right now is in the process of turning off all of its nuclear reactors, and it has made a significant move towards solar and wind power to where it's hoping by, you know, the next 10 to 15 years, it's going to have a majority of its power coming from renewable resources. Well, if a country like Germany can do that, there's no reason why the United States can't similar do that.
Louis, thanks for the call. Clark in West Bend, hi.
Hi, good morning. Well, I think there's several things that have come up there. This idea that I've got fits in rather well. We talked about green technology and putting people back to work. There's a fairly simple program that could be long-term and put many, many people, including a lot of semi and unskilled people, to work. And it could coordinate with the states. That would be to plant trees all along federal highways and even along county and city and state highways all across the nation. It would coordinate with local growers. It would coordinate with the states that already have experts in where that needs to happen. It could put villages that people from inner city could go out and live in a distant place and put trees along section of highways, you know, a week at a time. You could have engineers involved, designers. The small growers would then have more people in their local areas planting the seedlings to start with. And it's a program that could go on for years. And so it's a good intermittent thing, and it's also a good way for people to get new skills. It would get, we talked about the obesity problems. Well, people would get out there and work outdoors, and it's shovel ready.
Clearly there's no question that we need to replant trees. Clearly, I think it would help environmentally. It's one of several viable possibilities out there in terms of a broader plan. I mean, there used to be, and I don't know if it exists anymore. I can remember when my great aunt was a farmer. I think it was the agricultural department used to provide you know, money to provide the saplings to plant, you know, if you wanted to reforest your farm or something like that. I don't know if programs like that exist, but the point is, as your broader one is that there are a variety of ways of combining jobs programs with environmentally and energy efficient or energy wise ideas. And this is a great opportunity right now to be exploring those different proposals in terms of what to do.
Thanks, Clark. Ron in Evergreen. Hi. Whoa. Hi, Ron.
Hello. Good morning. Another great show. Thanks for taking my call. Kathleen, every time one of your guests mentions demand or consumer demand, I'd like you to say, what kind of jobs does that really create? Because as your guest is saying, you know, at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, they're saying, buy my toasters, buy my microwaves, buy my appliances. Well, what if we really hit, what kind of jobs does that create, first of all? Is that clerk-type jobs at big-box stores? What if we had entire industries that were back in this country and we actually made those appliances? You got to look at the jobs that this consumer demand really might produce. The solar thing is great, but what if we'd be bringing Chinese wind turbines and Chinese solar panels to this country? That's not going to create a lot of jobs. You're going to have some construction jobs again, assembling things, but bring back entire industries in this country. Demand for eyeglasses is here. You can't find a pair of eyeglasses that's not made in China.
Can't find much of anything that's not made in China. How do we bring those businesses back, sir?
Okay, a couple observations. First off, I was going to say I absolutely agree with the caller that the ultimate goal has to be to bring back manufacturing and other types of jobs in the United States, because clearly, you know, I mean, there's nothing wrong, you know, working as a clerk or as a salesperson at a store, but you need a variety of other types of jobs, and we need to be making things again. The story I like to tell, this was as a spoof, you know, for my garden, I decided to get a couple of those plastic pink flamingos earlier this year to put in my garden. You know where they were made? In the United States.
No!
One of the few things that I could find that was union-made in the United States were plastic pink flamingos. Now, I'm thrilled to death that it occurred, but I thought, my gosh, I can't get cars, I can't get steel, I can't get anything else made in the United States, but I can get plastic pink flamingos union-made in the United States.
And Professor Schultz, can you tell me what pleasure you find in those plastic pink flamingos in your backyard?
Just as a spoof. That's all it was. No pleasure outside of the fact they look great sitting next to my green tomato vines.
All right.
Okay. But no, I mean, it was just done as a joke. But the broader point was when I got them and I read the box and I said, my gosh, this is the only thing that I've been able to find in the last few years, again, both union made and in the United States. And the point is that we probably need a lot more of both of that. And that becomes, as a caller pointed out, the bigger issue here, is that, yeah, infrastructure, you know, it's kind of hard to outsource repaving roads in Madison, you know, to China. You know, it's got to be done in the United States, and it's got to be done, in Madison, you know. But we have to be thinking in terms of the fact that, you know, we have lots of people need, you know, refrigerators, you know, stoves, you know, whatever it may be. We need to be thinking about a variety of trade policies and a variety of perhaps tax policies, and more importantly, I think workforce development training policies that make it economically more viable for those jobs to be sourced in the United States and not sourced overseas.
Yeah.
So I absolutely agree.
Thanks. And in the meantime, just buy a lot more of those plastic pink flamingos to give to your friends for presents.
Right, that's right. Although for me, two in the backyard is enough.
Okay. Thanks, Ron, for the call. Andy in Lake Geneva. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Andy.
You know, your guest's assessment of Obama was in many ways so right on the mark as to why he really, you know, we have a problem here right now because of the man's background. And kind of number two is that I think the reason that he's just come in with a relatively small amount of money is, remember, he has to get this through a Republican Congress. All right, and they're not big on spending at all. And number three is, I think he's just trying to keep the unemployment rate from, frankly, going up, okay, from where it is. And going after the younger people is smart because of the fact that, you know, he has to get these young voters who put him into office in the first place. He's got to get them back in. But, and I mentioned this a while back, I think what is quite ominous, and I'd be interested to hear what your guests think and yourself, frankly, is the fact that Microsoft has opened up a major computer science research center in Beijing. If that doesn't tell you the situation, this is Microsoft.
All right, phone is cutting out, but we got what you said, Professor Schultz.
Okay, a couple of things. There's no question about the fact that on one level, Obama made a modest proposal with the hope that it would get through Congress. But again, you know, as many of your callers were pointing out, and as many of us are thinking at this point, I'm not sure any proposal that Obama puts forward is going to get adopted by the Republicans in the House of Representatives. And so the question becomes, do you propose something that you think the Republicans are going to support when, in fact, there's no chance that they're going to probably support anything? Or B, you actually make the proposal for something that will actually work, the more comprehensive idea, the bigger bill, and then run on that in terms of the broader vision. And that, I think, is sort of, you know, one of the debates here. Because, again, yet again, he's trying to propose something very reasonable, very modest, with the belief that the Republicans will support it, when, in fact, there's probably very little chance that they're going to be reasonable and say, well, yeah, it's a good proposal. Let's come together. So I think it's that strategy. It's still that belief that he somehow thinks he can reason across the aisles, and I'm not sure that's been a successful strategy at this point. Clearly, the speech, in part, was also aimed at rousing his base, because there's no question that a lot of people within the Democratic Party, the liberals within the party, are very distraught and very dispassionate about Obama at this point, and he needs to recapture that interest. Now, in terms of Microsoft, again, I don't know the details of their sort of new research facility over there, but again, it does speak to the fact that, you know, partly that we need, again, to be thinking about, you know, how do we encourage, you know, more facilities to locate in the United States. And part of this comes back down to education and workforce training. The single most important factor affecting where businesses are going to locate their facilities is the quality of the workforce. And, you know, we have statistics that point out that we have less and less undergraduates majoring in science, majoring in engineering, majoring in some of the types of skills and professions that we really need to attract. So we need to be thinking about how do we provide financial aid, support for schools, in ways that will encourage students to be able to go into those types of fields that are really critical for our next generation of businesses.
Mm-hmm. Andy, thanks for the call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. I want our guests to address this. I don't have a satisfactory answer yet. I keep asking this question, but I'm going to ask it again. What about these U.S. companies? And Professor Schultz makes reference to this in one of his recent pieces. U.S. companies sitting on nearly $2 trillion in cash, not willing to invest it in jobs. That's a lot of money. Why are they sitting on all of that money? What would cause businesses to invest? Is it, as some have suggested, the possibility of too many taxes down the road, too much regulation? That's what I've heard. What does he think? We'll talk about that and welcome many more of your phone calls. The number one line is open right now, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program, How We Teach Children About the Civil War. Ken Stark will join us, award-winning illustrator and painter, author of the children's book Marching to Appomattox, The Foot Race That Ended the Civil War, and illustrator of Seeing the Elephant, A Story of the Civil War. We'll also speak with the Deputy Director, Communications of the Civil War Trust, editor of Hallowed Ground. All right, we'll go back to phone calls in a moment, but I am on this. Why is there all this money that corporations are sitting on? Why are they sitting on $2 trillion in cash?
Well, two things. Where are they getting that $2 trillion in cash? Profits are dramatically up. People are forgetting that, is that a lot of the major companies are making a lot of money. They're now getting those profits, and what they're not doing is investing them in workers. Instead, what they're doing at this point is either doing stock buybacks if they're publicly traded, or they're paying them out in dividends, or they're just sitting on that cash simply because they're being very conservative in their strategy. And so in many ways, why are they sitting on it? Simply because they have no incentive to use that money in a more productive way and instead are channeling that money into, again, what I would argue, very unproductive ways. Again, just sitting on it, big companies buying big companies, or just paying dividends. All that's okay, but if your goal is to try to encourage them to be able to hire more individuals, you've got to create the incentive structures, tax policies that encourage them to invest in research development or into the hiring of new workers.
So tell me a little bit more about the incentive structure that is needed.
Well, one possibility would be to say that if they are unwilling to invest that in either research and development or hiring new workers, essentially at that point you have a very high tax rate that basically says if you don't spend it, we're going to tax it, and we're going to use that money then either for deficit reduction, for funding government infrastructure projects, or for tax relief or pay for other programs for middle-class America. I mean, I'll give one example I throw up in my blog at this point, is that the American Civil Engineering Society pointed out after that fine bridge in my hometown, you know, Minneapolis,
right,
collapsed a few years ago,
yeah,
pointed out that we need to spend $2.2 trillion on rebuilding all the roads and bridges, you know, in the United States that are dilapidated. You know, we could start at this point and take that $2 trillion if businesses aren't willing to invest in anything, and start to tax that and use that money for a massive multi-year infrastructure program to rebuild our infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
So that just becomes one idea right there. And that gets at the issue of sustainability, that the money is out there. There's an enormous amount of money out there being held by businesses, $2 trillion domestically, over $1 trillion in foreign accounts by businesses that could be used for job production and investment in the United States. And this is where tax policy can be very creative in terms of encouraging businesses to use that money productively or turn it over to somebody who can use it more productively.
Right. Well, I know you teach courses in ethics. Isn't there some element of social responsibility here, too? I know there are many corporations that feel that it is the broader good for them to create jobs. Where is that?
Well, clearly, I think they ought to be recognizing that. Now, many people will take sort of a very narrow view of social responsibility and say the only responsibility of businesses is to maximize shareholder value. But I think those days of sort of a narrow conception of what a business is supposed to do have passed. And most of us recognize the fact that we turn over to the private sector the primary responsibility to generate jobs for our society, to generate wealth. And with that comes the responsibility also of saying that we need to ensure that they pursue interests that are compatible with the interests of the United States and the American citizen. I mean, part of what some of your listeners have been hitting at is pointing out the fact that a lot of businesses in the United States are offshoring, shipping money overseas, setting up facilities overseas. Well, that's clearly in their business's interest to do that, but that economic self-interest of businesses comes in conflict with what should be the public good of the United States. And again, we can use appropriate regulation and appropriate tax policies to get business interests aligned with what is in line with the best interests of the country.
Marie in Milwaukee, hi.
Hello. I have a couple of points, but majorly, a little while back, you were talking about the solar industry kind of falling flat here in the United States. And it's always been my belief that the government plays a huge role in promoting the industries that we need, the technology that came out of that's out here now with all the computers and everything. That actually started with government. Government was the driver of that. And so I'm thinking, why isn't government the driver of green technology? Why aren't there solar panels on the White House? Why aren't there solar panels on the Pentagon? Why aren't there solar panels all over the Capitol? Why isn't the government providing a market for these so that other people, that these companies can go on and other people, and that'll get other people to understand that this is what we need to do. We need to retrofit our houses, retrofit our schools, retrofit everything, and put solar panels on top of every darn school in the country.
Professor Schultz.
I think that's an excellent suggestion. It really is, because I think you're right. The government can, with an enormous amount of purchasing power, really have a big impact on the economy. And I think your point is well taken. What if we just required that every single school, across the country, university, every government building across the United States, that they retrofit for solar power? That alone would have an enormous impact upon both energy consumption and upon stimulating the solar industry in the United States. And if the government is actually making the purchases itself, you know, it also is in the position of being able to require a domestic content. It could say that these panels have to be made in the United States. So I think you're absolutely right, and it would be in a wonderful direction to take. I mean, over the years, whether it be through the military, whether it be through NASA, whether it be through the creation of the interstate highway system in the 50s and 60s, the United States, and governments have had an important role in driving technology and encouraging technological innovation that has just really been the heart and soul of what the United States has done for so many years in terms of being the major innovator. And there's no reason why it can't do the same thing, both in terms of encouraging the innovation, but then in encouraging its application by applying it to, as you said, to government buildings in the United States.
Thank you, Marie, so much for your call. Bill in Madison, hi.
Hi. Two comments. One very brief. I firmly believe that so-called nominally American companies like General Electric, they just simply have, they're multinationals now, and they simply have no loyalty to any nation state anymore. And that's just a reality of life. Secondly, I believe that people are not turned off by Obama's professorial manner so much as the fact that he's a bad professor. There are perfectly good, common sense, logical ways for him to explain why his programs will work and the Republicans' obsession with taxes and deficits and regulations is wrong-headed. And he doesn't ever explain that. He's trying to take the Republicans. Republicans are masters at appealing to the very lowest common denominator, emotional, gut-level base. And he tries to play that game and fails miserably.
Professor Schultz.
Yeah, I wasn't laughing at you. I was laughing at the observation about being a bad professor, because I actually think that's not a bad argument to make there. I mean, I'm thinking about in the state of Minnesota where I am, there was a former professor, Paul Wellstone, who went on to become an incredibly successful U.S. senator before the plane crash took him out. And he was both a great professor and, once U.S. senator, he still was a professor, but he was great at explaining his positions and still having great passion. And I think the hallmark of good teaching is that capacity to have passion and the capacity to explain. And I think there's an interesting observation that the caller made here, is that I think you're right. I think what Obama hasn't done is become the good professor that he was perhaps during the campaign, where he had both the inspiring rhetoric, the making the arguments in favor of his positions. And maybe that's what he needs to be, is to be the professor that is much better than he has been in the last 3 years in terms of how he takes on the Republicans.
Thanks, Bill, for the call. Let's get to one more call. We're almost out of time. Alan in Manitowoc. Hi.
Hi. I used to work for a company that used to take care of all the windmills out in Palm Springs, California.
Hmm.
Are you familiar with those?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And at that time, we had a problem with maintaining all the electricity. It was unable to work. Only 25% of all the windmills out in that area actually worked. at a certain time. And from what I understood, it was not a private owner. It was the government that paid for all that. I don't know how the private sector can compete with the government. So I'm thinking this windmill situation and a lot of this solar energy, just they don't know how to make it work yet.
What do you think? We got about 30 seconds, Professor Schultz.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, if we look at sort of how solar energy has improved over the years, it used to be that we got very little electricity out of the solar panels and cells. The efficiencies have dramatically improved. Again, this is part of sort of research and development. Again, the kind of things that the government could be funding and encouraging through tax credits for R&D.
All right, you did it. Perfect. Perfect. Less than 30. Thank you so much for being with us. It was a good hour. Thank you.
You're welcome at any time. Bye.
All right. Thanks. Professor David Schultz, our guest professor in the Hamline University School of Business, teaches public, nonprofit, and business administration. He's also a professor of law at the University of Minnesota Law School. And we thank him for his time. Covered a lot of territory. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios, and thank you for your calls. We will return. Civil War, how do we teach it to children? Stay with us. That's coming up in just a little while.